KPLO FM program, Power to People.
That document cannot meaningfully be described without revealing classified information.
The Bush administration hid behind the state secrets privilege to spy on the American people. President Obama promised change, but recent court battles suggest the threats to our civil liberties will continue. Will the Obama administration continue to use the privilege of the presidency to hide unconstitutional actions from the public? We the People talked to Portland attorney Tom Nelson earlier this week to discuss how a local case of illegal spying could shed some light on the future of government surveillance on Americans. Join us this Thursday evening at 6 when We the People will take your calls to explore these questions and discuss your concerns. Listen and tell us what you think. We the People, last Thursday at 6 p.m., www.kboo.fm/we the people.
I'm Lena Aliyalura.
This is Scott Fink.
This is Linda Olsen Austin.
This is Owen Bastable.
I'm Cicely Rogers.
I'm Lisa Lewis.
I'm Brian Pritchett.
This is Rebecca Nay.
I'm Robert Barnhold.
Volunteer-run, community-powered. This is the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Omnibus Public Lands Bill passes the House of Representatives.
The City Council hears citizen concerns about closing of Portland's water reservoirs.
And China suggests a global currency.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 25th, 2009. I'm Nia Lewis.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. The House of Representatives has passed the Omnibus Public Lands Bill today. The legislation, which was authored by Oregon Senator Ron Wyden and championed in the House by Oregon Representative Earl Blumenauer, will protect almost 130,000 acres around Mount Hood. In total, the bill will designate almost 200,000 acres of land in Oregon as protected wilderness area. It will also add almost 100 miles of free-flowing rivers to our state. Of the bill, Congressman Blumenauer said, "Our state boasts some of the nation's most beautiful natural wonders. By working together across the aisle, we've preserved an important piece of Oregon's national history for generations to come." The bill now goes to President Obama for his signature.
At City Hall today, advocates and residents of Section 8 housing addressed the City Council regarding rampant inadequacies with Portland's Central City concern. Within the testimony were complaints of rodents and pests, mismanagement, crime, and inadequate background checks of tenants in low-barrier communities. One resident of the Biltmore Hotel, a Section 8 housing facility in downtown Portland, claims to have witnessed drug deals between a building manager and a tenant. After all of the testimony, Commissioner Nick Fish told the speakers he shares their concern and that he has preemptively spoken with the Central City concern.
As the housing commissioner, what I want to say is that what some of the issues that have been identified go to the heart of something that we talk about all the time, which is, do we have enough resources to match housing with services? Because without services, we're not meeting the needs. And I don't want to just turn this into a plug for my budget request, but I'd be remiss if I didn't at least frame the issue that the service component of what we do is what makes the housing work. And Central City Concern is asked to do a very important job with inadequate resources. And so I'll be coming back to you talking about the services side of the equation. But because of the issues that have been framed, I just want to note for the record that we've asked that three things happen as a result of the concerns that you've raised. I've asked Central City Concern to provide some documentation to my bureau, the Housing Bureau, concerning the code and safety issues which have been raised, so we will be reviewing that. The Bureau of Development Services has agreed to provide inspections for tenants who have a pest issue and believe there's a problem. BDS inspectors are and will take a look to see whether those issues have been adequately addressed. And to those of you who are here and to those who live there, I urge you to use and access community resources like the Community Alliance of Tenants and other folks who are advocates for tenants and buildings. My job isn't to make a judgment on these things. My job and the city's job is to make sure that everybody who is housed directly or indirectly by the city has a decent place to call home.
That was Commissioner Nick Fish addressing concerned residents of Portland's Central City Concern.
also at the City Council meeting today. Members of the community addressed the board regarding the LT2 rule Portland will soon be required to comply with. The national rule established by the Environmental Protection Agency would force Portland officials to close or cover our 5 open water reservoirs and to perform new expensive tests and treatments at the Bull Run water source. The city's position has been against enforcing the LT2 rule and has frequently addressed their concerns to the EPA, but requests for waivers or variants have been repeatedly denied. Citizens speaking to the LT2 rule in today's meeting suggested everything from outright disobedience to direct talks between the city and President Obama. Regna Mera, the executive director of the environmental group Oregon Wild, explained her organization's position regarding noncompliance with the EPA rule.
We worked for over 20 years to protect the Bull Run, often encouraging the Water Bureau and the City Council to seek legislation to protect the Bull Run and then working in partnership with the Council to secure that legislative agenda. Protecting the legacy of Bull Run and the public health of Portland residents is a shared responsibility that we take very seriously. This has been a difficult journey, and though we're not all on the same page at the same time, I do believe that we're all working in good faith to protect and preserve our water system and our pure water and the system that delivers it. I have strong faith that in the end, our combined efforts will serve future generations well. We certainly appreciate the work of Commissioner Leonard and Council, your support for the city's legal challenge to the LT2 regs. We and Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility joined as amicus partners in that legal challenge, and your efforts to achieve alternative methods of compliance, including the one that we consider to be the best method, legislative relief. We do not support the proposal to build a filtration plant and take our reservoirs offline. This is a tremendously costly fix to a problem that exists elsewhere, but not in. With regard to filtration, constructed to filter out infectious crypto, a filtration system won't do that. It won't do that here. Why? Because we have little to no cryptosporidium in our protected watershed. We have no evidence of cryptosporidium specifically infectious to humans, and no evidence of any cryptosporidium infections originating in our drinking water system, which was put in place over 100 years ago. We have such pure water because of the historic protections against human entry and associated human and bovine waste. The general prohibition on entry into the Bull Run Management Unit by humans of Ceridium will not pose a public health threat. Consistent water purity is a direct result of isolation from human entry and development and the exclusion of livestock. That's what makes our watershed unique. Oregon Wild and others toiled for years to protect the Bull Run from logging and development that would force costly treatment. We achieved the highest standard of legislative protection in 1996 and 2001. We are now faced with a bitter irony. Construction of a filtration system will create new demand to open the watershed to logging, development, and human entry. The argument? Why should logging and development interests be hampered by site-specific Bull Run safeguards if Portland's water is filtered? The cost of building a plant is mind-boggling, particularly during these terrible economic times. The city has critical needs that must be met, including public health and safety needs, and this is not one of them. These are the reasons why we are focusing our energy on securing a legislative remedy from LT2. And for these reasons, we respectfully ask that you not sign the report unless it's modified to, number one, request an extension in compliance deadlines from the EPA, the DC EPA, and the Obama administration. The EPA does grant extensions for dirty water systems to comply all the time. Two, request that the Oregon congressional delegation support the city and its request for such an extension. Three, do not spend any city money on construction of LT2-only projects. And four, implement and maintain an aggressive effort to secure legislative relief. And don't give up.
That was Regna Mera addressing the Portland City Council regarding the EPA rule to force the building of a testing center and the Bull Run water source. There will be another City Council meeting to discuss the LT2 rule on April 11th.
The nation's second largest school district has voted to make Cesar Chavez's March 31st birthday a school holiday. The school board resolution approved yesterday calls for Superintendent Ramon Cortinez to come up with a plan to drop another holiday in favor of the day off to honor the late United Farmworkers co-founder. Board member Yoli Flores Aguilar, who introduced the resolution, says a school holiday honoring Chavez is long overdue. The state legislature adopted a bill in 2000 establishing March 31st as a state holiday. It calls for schools to be closed if their school board agreed. The Los Angeles Unified School District resolution also calls for reestablishing service learning projects in the spirit of Chavez by the 2010-2011 school year.
This week marks the 30th anniversary of the Three Mile Island nuclear disaster. Three Mile Island was the worst accident in the history of commercial nuclear power here in the United States. On March 28, 1979, the most feared reactor accident, a core meltdown, which the nuclear industry had continually assured the public could never happen, almost did happen. A report by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission concluded that the Three Mile Island plant came within 30 to 60 minutes of a full meltdown. In fact, the core of the reactor did undergo a partial melting. To commemorate the anniversary, anti-nuclear activists are calling on the Obama administration to abandon plans for nuclear energy plants and to look to solar, wind, and geothermal energy instead. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Harvey Wasserman, who was a reporter in Pennsylvania at the time of the disaster.
Do you know what is the current status of some of the people who did suffer from that nuclear disaster? What happened with their lawsuits, and where are they at now?
Well, tragically, after 30 years, the 2,400 families that filed a class action suit, actually they did it in the 1980s, have been unable to get a court hearing. The federal courts have ruled so far that not enough radiation escaped to do the kinds of harm that these people suffered, even though the government does not know how much radiation escaped. And so these people, 2,400 families filed in the mid-1980s, they've still been unable to get a federal court hearing, and I can guarantee you the people were killed, maimed with those radiation releases, and yet the people there have been unable to get any kind of hearing in the federal court system. It's a travesty.
Is there any hope that they may still get justice for what happened at Three Mile Island?
Well, there's always hope, and we continue to hope that the legal cases that were filed will someday get a hearing, and hopefully this administration, if it wants to really examine the possibilities of going nuclear, they could start with looking at what happened at Three Mile Island, because their justice has never been done there, and the truth has not been told. As a matter of fact, today there's a public announcement in Harrisburg of a new study that indicates that, in fact, the statistics show increased cancers and other health effects, and that far more radiation escaped from Three Mile Island than was previously believed. And I think if this administration seriously wants to examine the nuclear power option, they ought to look at what really did happen at Three Mile Island.
President Obama has called for an expansion of nuclear facilities as part of his energy program. What would be your advice to him and the new administration regarding nuclear power?
Forget it. Nuclear power is a complete catastrophe. After 50 years, they cannot get private financing. They cannot guarantee the safety of these reactors. They cannot guarantee that a jet crashing into the nuclear plants wouldn't cause an apocalyptic radiation release. The amount of radiation at Three Mile Island exceeded all expectations. We still don't know exactly how much went out or where it came down. And at any of the existing reactors, all of which have been operating for more than 30 years, Three Mile Island Unit 2 operated only 3 months, the amounts of radiation coming out would vastly exceed the radiation doses from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There's absolutely no reason to build any new nuclear plants, and the ones that are operating need to be shut down. Any money thrown at building new reactors is a complete waste.
Now, your new book is calling for a kind of a solar revolution. What do you think is going to be the advantage of switching over to solar power?
Well, Solartopia is built around a vision of no coal, oil, nukes, or gas. We are fighting King Kong here. Coal, oil, nukes, and gas are all obsolete. We need fuels that are natural-based, not fossil-based, and not nuclear. And we have the technology now. If we swept the planet clean of all fossil and nuclear generating stations, we could technologically replace them all with solar, wind, tidal, geothermal, increased efficiency, mass transit, biofuels, the whole deal. And so Solartopia is a vision of a post-fossil nuclear world, and the technology's there, and it and needs to happen, because we will not survive economically or ecologically if we continue with fossil and nuclear fuels. They have got to be done away with.
So if the technology is there, the knowledge and the resources are there, I guess what's lacking is the political will right now?
Well, we actually have to change the nature of the corporation. The single largest barrier to switching to a solartopian economy is the inherent power of the corporation. Under our law, the corporations have human rights but no human responsibilities, and this has to change. The institutional barrier is primarily the unaccountability of our business structure. We don't see any indication yet that the Obama administration is going to deal with that one.
Again, I've been speaking with Harvey Wasserman, the author of the new book, Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030. This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
In the human cost of occupation in Iraq, U.S. officials have noted an increase in attacks against Iraq's police and military in an area south of Baghdad, even as violence nationally in Iraq dropped to similar levels of mid-2003. A car bomb killed 3 children in Mosul, in northern Iraq today. Also in Mosul, an Iraqi police officer was killed by unknown gunmen. Also, gunmen shot dead a civilian on Tuesday in central Kirkuk. The exact number of civilians killed in Iraq since 2003 is unknown, since neither the U.S. nor Iraqi governments do body counts of civilian casualties in the conflict. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by The Underground, KBOO's Youth Collective Show, at 6. Tomorrow's weather is mostly cloudy with a high near 53. Calm wind becoming north-northwest between 4 and 7 miles per hour.
Current time is 5:16, and now, Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
Like me, you might have had a piggy bank when you were a child. Putting pennies in the little fat pig was considered such a sweet act of frugality, a Kodak moment for many families. Today, though, thanks to Wall Street banksters, the term piggy bank is no longer endearing. Instead of pennies, we're stuffing trillions of our tax dollars into these piggies, and there's nothing sweet about it. Not only had they grabbed the money and run, refusing to use the public's largesse to start making the loans America needs, but they've also insulted us with such flagrant displays of arrogance as giving bonuses to top executives and redecorating their executive suites. Throughout it all, there's been a ridiculous amount of secrecy. Both Wall Street and Washington have routinely tried to hide who's getting the money, how much, and what's being done with it. One of the most offensive examples of the shell game has been the nauseating $170 billion bailout of the insurance behemoth AIG. A huge chunk of this money was passed through AIG as a backdoor bailout for various banks. Which ones? None of our business, we're told. Finally, though, when public anger became so explosive that AIG officials hired private security guards to protect them from taxpayers, the company fessed up. Not only were once proud Wall Street barons taking these secret handouts, but various foreign banks were also making off with our billions. For example, Societe Generale of France and Deutsche Bank of Germany took about $12 billion each, while Barclays of England and UBS of Switzerland got more than $5 billion each. This is Jim Hightower saying, apparently we need to rewrite the message on our Statue of Liberty. Instead of saying to the world, send us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free, it should say, send us your inept, corrupt, and greedy rich yearning to be bailed out.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go With the Flow. now available wherever books are sold.
U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton said today that America's insatiable demand for illegal drugs and inability to stop weapons smuggling into Mexico are fueling an alarming spike in violence along the U.S.-Mexican border. Clinton said the United States shares responsibility with Mexico for dealing with the violence. She said the administration will work with Mexican authorities to improve security on both sides of the border. Obama himself said yesterday that he wanted the U.S. to do more to prevent guns and cash from illicit drug sales from flowing across the border into Mexico. Mexican officials have in the past, particularly under the Bush administration, complained that Washington never acknowledged the extent that the U.S. demand for drugs and weapon smuggling played in fueling the violence.
Iran has accepted an invitation to a conference on Afghanistan next week that also will be attended by the U.S., the conference's Dutch host said today. Foreign Minister Maxime Verhagen said it's not yet clear who Tehran will send. The invitation to Iran, which was first announced by U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton, was seen as part of Washington's policy towards greater engagement with the Islamic Republic. Verhagen said the invitation fit Europe's two-track approach of offering inducements to Iran to cooperate with the international community while maintaining sanctions for pursuing its nuclear program. U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and Afghan President Hamid Karzai will open the meeting of nearly 80 countries and 20 international organizations. President Barack Obama is preparing a sweeping U.S. policy review towards Afghanistan and Pakistan, where Taliban insurgents have taken refuge.
China has called for a new global currency to replace the dollar ahead of the G20 summit next week. The proposal reflects a growing unease in China about the nation's reliance of the dollar for most of its trade and its foreign reserves. Both the United States and European Union have dismissed the idea. While the dollar has been the world's most widely used currency for decades, the governor of China's central bank said the financial crisis has exposed the existing flaws in the international monetary system. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke did hint at the possibility of a global economic order in a speech to the Council on Foreign Relations earlier this month.
We must have a strategy that regulates the financial system as a whole, in a holistic way, not just at its individual components. In particular, strong and effective regulation and supervision of banking institutions, although necessary for reducing systemic risk, are not sufficient by themselves to achieve this aim. Today, I would like to talk about four key elements of such a strategy. First, we must address the problem of financial institutions that are deemed too big or perhaps too interconnected to fail. Second, we must strengthen what I will call the financial infrastructure, the systems, rules, and conventions that govern trading, payment, clearing, and settlement in financial markets to ensure that it will perform well under stress. Third, we should review regulatory policies and accounting rules to ensure that they do not induce excessive pro-cyclicality. That is, they do not overly magnify the ups and downs in the financial system and in the economy. And finally, we should consider whether the creation of an authority specifically charged with monitoring and addressing systemic risks would help protect the system from financial crises like the one we are currently experiencing.
That was Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke speaking earlier this month, proposing a new global economic authority, although he didn't go so far as to endorse a global currency.
Syria's president said today that last year's unofficial peace talks with Israel failed because Israel refused to return Syrian territory seized in the 1967 war. The territory, known as the Golan Heights, provides up to 30% of Israel's water, according to the Israeli Water Board. The newly formed Israeli government has vowed to never return the Syrian territory. Previously, Syrian officials said they suspended the talks in protest of Israel's war in Gaza, which began in late December. However, Syrian President Bashar Assad admitted in an interview today that the talks actually failed due to Israel's refusal to negotiate on the issue of the Golan Heights. Assad said Syria had specified some points of land on the Galilee shores and the Jordan River that he wanted returned. Israelis have argued in the past that a 21-square-mile area along the sea was originally Palestinian, not Syrian, and therefore need not be returned to Syria with the rest of the Golan. But the Israeli government has stated that they have no plan to return the land to the indigenous Palestinians.
A new report today has called for an investigation of Israeli war crimes in connection with the indiscriminate firing of white phosphorus shells over densely populated areas of Gaza. The New York-based group Human Rights Watch called on the United Nations to launch an investigation into alleged Israeli violations of the rules of war. This includes the use of white phosphorus during its three-week Gaza offensive. KBOO's Crystal Leedy spoke with a representative from Human Rights Watch about the report.
Today we've issued a report on the widespread use of phosphorus by the Israeli Defense Forces during Operation Cast Lead in Gaza. When they were using white phosphorus, airburst artillery would be exploding over densely populated areas throughout the Gaza Strip, but primarily in Gaza City. When each artillery shell would open up in midair, it would rain down just about 13 pounds of burning phosphorus onto the civilian population. And so we at Human Rights Watch are calling for an independent international investigation into what we're terming right now as the clear evidence of war crimes.
And you do have evidence from people who are now hospitalized and otherwise victims of this.
That's right, absolutely. Well, in fact, they're watching the fighting as it was ongoing. We were standing with my team on the armistice line on the Israel border, watching the artillery shells and the fire raining down. Then when we went into Gaza, finally were able to get in through Egypt, we were finding the spent shells, the pieces of phosphorus that if you kick them, even days later, they would ignite. And of course, we met victims who were in hospitals in the burn units. It was quite a difficult situation to fix. They've got a tough road to hoe. The white phosphorus continues to burn once it hits the skin until all. And so it does burn the bone, and these people have some horrific injuries.
Thank you so much for giving us this information.
Yeah, please go to our website, www.hrw.org, and we have the full text of the report.
That was Crystal Leedy speaking with Human Rights Watch about their new report on Israel's use of white phosphorus in the Gaza Strip.
Israeli troops shut down a press conference in Jerusalem today, and two of the participants were beaten. Several journalists reported being prevented from reaching the area known as the protest tent. The tent in Sheikh Jarrah is where the Al-Kur family is living after being evicted from their home. The press conference was held as part of the Al-Quds Capital Culture events as a symbol of solidarity with the Al-Kur family. Israeli troops detained 11 people, including Sheikh Raed Salah, head of the Islamic movement in Israel.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, March 25, 2009. Israeli Navy forces attacked fishermen in Gaza and troops shot a boy in the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Israeli Navy attacked a Palestinian fishing boat, kidnapping the four fishermen who were abroad, and took over the boat on Wednesday morning, local sources reported. The fishermen, three brothers and a relative, were taken to unknown destination. They were fishing in Palestinian territorial waters near Rafah, in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, witnesses said. Locals say the Israeli Navy frequently attack fishermen and shell Palestinian fishing boats and have wounded and kidnapped dozens of fishermen before. Earlier this week, a young Palestinian fisherman was shot and seriously wounded when the Israeli Navy shelled an area northeast of Gaza City. In other news, Israeli soldiers shot and seriously wounded a Palestinian youth at the Hawara roadblock south of the northern West Bank city of Nablus on Wednesday morning. Local sources said that the boy was shot by the Israeli troops, then soldiers called an ambulance and took the boy away. Meanwhile, the Palestinian News and Information Agency, WAFA, reported on Wednesday morning that Israeli soldiers kidnapped 17 Palestinian civilians after the army invaded a number of villages and cities in the West Bank. The army invaded Nablus, Ramallah, and Hebron, broke into and searched dozens of homes. The Israeli Civil Court of Khedera extended on Wednesday the detention of 22 young men who were taken by the police on Tuesday during the clashes that took place in the town of Umm al-Fahm in northern Israel. The residents tried to stop Israeli right-wing groups from marching into the town. During Tuesday's clashes, the Israeli police attacked residents and local community leaders in Umm al-Fahm, injuring 8 civilians, including one critically. Thank you for joining us from Occupy Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Banoura and George Ishmawi.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we welcome your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Brendan Grubb. Special thanks to reporter Crystal Lady and Dane Gatewood. Our engineer is Brianna Loringer. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Nia Lewis. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge Talk Radio, Joanne and Dave talk with members of Passin' Art, a theater company, about their production of A Sunbeam by award-winning playwright John Henry. This unique production of play about a family torn apart by problems includes talkback sessions with cast members and professionals from the Avell Gordley Center for Healing. At 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, Per Fogering interviews economist Ravi Batra about the future and the economic meltdown. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15, investigative news radio on Flashpoint. At 11, it's Between the Covers. And at 11:30, the guest is Karen Coulter of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. And now, stay tuned for national and international news from the Worker Run Collective at Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, the 25th of March, 2009. From Oaxaca, Mexico, I'm Shannon Young, sitting in for Aura Bogado. President Obama meets with congressional leaders to discuss his 2010 budget requests. Amnesty International calls for immediate action to overhaul the U.S. system of immigration detention. And we'll go to Egypt, where the blogging community continues to thrive despite government crackdowns and censorship. All that and more after the headlines.
I'm Renee Feltz with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The British government says it will hold an inquiry into the legality of the Iraq War, but not until July, after the bulk of its troops have been withdrawn. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
For years, campaigners have called for a full independent inquiry into Britain's entry into and ongoing involvement in the invasion and occupation of Iraq. Whether they'll be satisfied by what Foreign Secretary David Miliband calls a comprehensive inquiry remains to be seen. There have already been two inquiries into aspects of British military action in Iraq, but neither were able to look into how the decision to invade Iraq was made and why planning for post-war Iraq was so inadequate. The findings won't be released before the UK's next general election. To this day, the government refuses to release the advice given in the lead-up to the military action by the Attorney General on the legality of the war. Since the invasion, 179 British troops have been killed, along with an estimated 90 to 100,000 Iraqi civilians. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
Complaints from low-wage workers often go uninvestigated by the Labor Department. A GAO report released today says the Labor Department's Wage and Hour Division often closes cases when employers don't return phone calls. An undercover investigation also found that the agency took longer than a year to respond to some complaints. When investigators filed a false child labor complaint, they received no response after a four-month wait. The report also found a division policy that instructs offices not to record unsuccessful consultations in its database. A key GOP vote for a union organizing bill is gone. Senator Arlen Specter says he'll vote against the Employee Free Choice Act. The bill would allow workers to unionize when a majority of employees in their workplace sign cards in favor. Labor organizers hope it will boost union membership. They've spent millions in lobbying lawmakers, and so have the corporations who oppose the bill. Without Specter's vote, the GOP will likely filibuster the bill. A group that won better pay and working conditions for workers who pick tomatoes for fast food giants and supermarkets has launched a new campaign. This one targets food service industry giants who have multi-million dollar contracts to supply food to universities. Andalusia Knoll reports.
The Student Farm Worker Alliance wants Aramark, Sodexo, and Compass to leverage their purchasing power to ensure better wages and living conditions for the Florida workers who pick the tomatoes they purchase. The Alliance argues the three food service contractors use their size and influence to demand large amounts of tomatoes at very low prices. Alliance member Mark.
And we have a situation in the fields today where the working conditions are so bad that sometimes it even tips over into actual modern-day slavery. So we're calling on these corporations to use that power and the resources that they have to improve conditions for farm workers.
Past campaigns by the Student Farm Worker Alliance, along with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, have reached successful agreements with McDonald's, Burger King, Subway, and Whole Foods. The companies agreed to pay a penny more per pound for the tomatoes they purchase, as well as partner with farm workers to ensure better working conditions. Members of the alliance say they'll hold creative actions in the next few months at universities across the country. Andalusia Knoll, FSRN, Philadelphia.
And in New York, millions of people who use public transportation face a fare hike in the middle of a recession. The Transit Authority voted today to raise subway, bus, and suburban train fares 20% to 30%. Abdullahi Bah has more.
Today's vote means that starting May 31st, a base fare to ride the subway or bus will cost $2.50, up from the current $2. Monthly passes will also go up. As Bethany Smith waited for the N train, she told FSRN the increase is unfair.
A lot of people are strapped for money already, and I already pay $81 a month for my monthly fare, and to pay $101 is going to take away from me paying my rent and everything else I have to do for the monthly.
Thousands of transit workers could also lose their job as part of the service cuts. The MTA says the fare increase is needed to help close a $1.2 billion deficit. They voted to approve the fare hike after state lawmakers failed to provide funds to avoid the increase. Abdullahi Bah, FSRN, New York City.
From the Community News Production Institute in New York, I'm Renee Phelps.
A Senate panel heard testimony from Christopher Hill, nominated for the position of U.S. ambassador to Iraq. Concerns over Hill's negotiations with North Korea during the Bush administration are holding up his nomination. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Ambassador Christopher Hill will be responsible for diplomatic relations with Iraq at a time when the U.S.'s militaristic role is winding down and its civilian role is expanding. President Obama has said he will withdraw all combat troops by the end of 2011, leaving 50,000 non-combat forces for humanitarian and other non-military purposes, as well as contractors. Senator Russ Feingold, Democrat of Wisconsin, expressed concern with the residual troops.
I'm concerned that it could undermine some of the positive aspects of redeployment, for example, leading Iraqis to question whether we will ultimately leave, and by preventing us from focusing adequately on the serious national security challenges we face around the globe. I'd like your reaction to that.
Christopher Hill responds.
The president's decision was made in careful consultation with the commanders in the field. And I think what the president is very concerned about is as we reduce forces, and reducing substantial forces in the months ahead, we need to be prepared for the bumps in the road.
Hill says that passage of Iraq's oil law is crucial to Iraq's economic and political system. He also says Iran is problematic.
My understanding is that the Iraqis are concerned about Iranian influence in Iraq. We are concerned about Iranian influence in Iraq. I think overall our approach to Iran is now under a policy review. Iraq and Iran need a good relationship, and a good relationship would be served by Iranian respect for sovereignty in Iraq.
Christopher Hill has had a long diplomatic career. Ambassador to Macedonia and Poland, special envoy to Kosovo, where he led peace negotiations. Most recently, at the State Department, he was appointed by President Bush to be in charge of negotiations with North Korea. Some are pointing to his actions in that position as reason for concern. A group of five Republican senators have announced they plan to hold up Hill's confirmation because he moved forward on relations with North Korea despite allegations of Korean nuclear proliferation and human rights abuses. Hill addresses those concerns.
Senator Brownback, quite rightly, and I fully respect this position, said we can't be normalizing with a country with one of the world's worst human rights records.
Hill says he was abiding to direct orders from Secretary of State.
So I agreed to recommend to create a human rights track. So as we're going forward in normalization, this was not just going to be a normalization, you give up the nukes and we treat you like you're some ally. This is a normalization that would include dealing with some of the issues that serious issues that stand between us.
Republican Senator Lindsey Graham also has concerns.
I think this is such an important post. For me, one of the most important assignments the president will give anybody, to have someone not connected to the region at all, and this be your first introduction to the Mideast, is probably not what I would have preferred.
Democrats had hoped to confirm him within the next week, but Republican opposition could stall the process. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
President Obama visited Capitol Hill today to meet with Democrats to rally support behind his $3.6 trillion budget. Top Democrat on the Senate Budget Committee, Kent Conrad, made major cuts to Obama's blueprint, but downplayed the differences.
We preserve his key priorities, energy, education, health care, dramatic reduction in the deficit, extending the middle class tax cuts from 2001 and 2003. It is true. I have asked for reductions in spending. I have asked for not only on the discretionary side, but on the mandatory side. I've also asked for certain revenue breaks to be offset, because everybody has to participate if we are going to accomplish a budget that's fiscally responsible and utterly and sustainable.
But Conrad's cuts stripped from Obama's budget an $800 tax cut for working families passed in the stimulus. Conrad also removed a controversial carbon cap and trade program. Overall, the cuts result in a $600 billion reduction over 5 years. At yesterday evening's primetime press conference, Obama said he expects the budget priorities to remain the same.
Now, we never expected when we printed out our budget that they would simply Xerox it and vote on it. We assume that it has to go through the legislative process. I have not yet seen the final product coming out of the Senate or the House, and we're in constant conversations with them. I am confident that the budget we put forward will have those principles in place. When it comes to the middle-class tax cut, we already had that in the recovery. We know that that's going to be in place for at least the next 2 years. We had identified a specific way to pay for it. If Congress has better ideas in terms of how to pay for it, then we're happy to listen. When it comes to cap and trade, the broader principle is that we've got to move to a new energy era. And that means moving away from polluting energy sources towards cleaner energy sources. That is a potential engine for economic growth. I think cap and trade is the best way, from my perspective, to achieve some of those gains, because what it does is it starts pricing the pollution that's being sent into the atmosphere.
Obama said he understood that changes must be made to win the necessary support of enough lawmakers for it to pass. Republicans called the budget proposals too expensive. The House and Senate budget committees are writing the budget today and tomorrow. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. Visit us online at fsrn.org to download today's audio or browse through our archives. That's fsrn.org. The U.S. system of immigration detention is arbitrary, abusive, and needs immediate reform, according to a report released today by Amnesty International. The U.S. government now holds more than 30,000 immigrants in detention on any given day. That's tripled the capacity of a decade ago. Amnesty's investigation reports that asylum seekers, torture victims, and immigrants who have committed no criminal offense often languish in jails without due process alongside violent offenders. Jared Marshallden reports.
The Federal Immigration Facility at 630 Sansom Street looks like any other building in San Francisco's financial district. Officially, the building is open to the public, but the security guards don't let in recording devices. Here's what I saw when I went to watch a hearing for detained immigrants. Several armed guards lead a dozen immigrants into a small court on the fourth floor. Some have been awake since 2:30 a.m. They wear matching red sweatsuits and plastic flip-flops that slap the tile floors. Shackled together, they sit at the back of the room. One pro bono lawyer makes his way over to all of those without a lawyer. Just before the judge begins questioning them, he asks, "What is your name?" and offers a bit of advice. While this is just one snapshot of what immigrants experience, Amnesty's investigation provides a detailed look at what the 30,000 immigrants detained on average each day face in the U.S. detention system. Amnesty says the U.S. uses detention as immigration control, which amounts to human rights abuse. And even after 20 or 30 years of permanent residence, immigrants may face deportation if charged with a crime. Benefsha Akloghi is the Western Director of Amnesty International.
It's very easy to have your status as an immigrant always be temporary in this country. We saw after 9/11 that a whole new group of people started to look over their shoulders.
Those detained include asylum seekers, lawful permanent residents, parents of children who are U.S. citizens, and survivors of human trafficking or torture. The report says immigrants are not afforded the basic elements of due process.
Unfortunately, in immigration court, unlike criminal court, people are not entitled to a free lawyer.
Eugene Chechenin is an attorney who works with the Community Legal Center.
And for instance, if you could see it today, I had to basically talk to like 5 or 10 people today, and many of them, they said that they did not have money to hire an attorney.
The report concurs with others recently released and objects to the treatment of immigrants in detention, many of whom are detained on civil, not criminal, charges. Many are held in private detention centers, which are less transparent and accountable than federal and state facilities. 74 immigrants have died in detention over the last 5 years. They do not have medical care.
There were fights, there were violence, there were rules that you have to follow over there. If you didn't follow, they would beat you up.
During those 7 months, he says he saw the sun for less than an hour in total. Under these conditions, many immigrants grow desperate and opt for a deportation order rather than stay in detention indefinitely while they plead their case. Again, Benefsha Akloghi.
The way in which we house human beings, it's unconscionable. It's not what we stand for in this country. And it's not what we stand for as human beings. It's a violation of their dignity. And that's not American.
Akwogi says the widespread abuse in immigration detention amounts to a domestic Guantanamo. The report recommends that the U.S. legally make detention a measure of last resort. It cites the lack of oversight and accountability as a major reason for abuse and calls for the passage of enforceable detention standards. Immigration and Customs Enforcement did not grant FSRN's request for an interview, but the head of the agency has issued a directive to recognize the need to review immigration detention. Jared Marshallden, FSRN, San Francisco.
You can find a link to the Amnesty International report on the U.S. immigration detention system on our website at fsrn.org. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Mexico ahead of next month's planned visit by President Barack Obama. Topping the agenda are the issues of drug cartel violence and a trade dispute over the cancellation of a pilot program to allow Mexican truckers to operate inside the U.S. The sharp downturn of the Mexican economy is also a likely topic of conversation. The U.S. recession has affected Mexico with tens of thousands of job losses in the manufacturing sector, and the Mexican peso has lost 40% of its value against the dollar in the past 5 months. Mexican President Felipe Calderón put together a stimulus package to help Mexico weather the economic crisis, but critics say it won't be enough. Tanya Snyder has the story.
Conventional wisdom says that when the U.S. gets a cold, Latin America gets pneumonia. Mexico is battening down the hatches in preparation for the economic storm. Mexico's economy grew by only 2% in 2008 as it felt the impacts of the global economic downturn. That's a steep decline in growth rates, which have averaged about 3.5% annually since the peso crisis in 1995. And it's expected to get much worse this year. Antonio Ortiz is the head of the Economic Affairs section at the Mexican Embassy in Washington, D.C.
Because if we rely only on the U.S. market, we are vulnerable to the swings of the U.S. market.
The United States buys nearly 80% of Mexico's exports. With U.S. buying power down, Mexican exports drop. And with unemployment rates high in the U.S. and disproportionately high for immigrants, remittances to family members back in Mexico are slowing down too. Another problem is oil. Oil revenues have traditionally accounted for 40% of the Mexican government's budget, but their reserves are dwindling and prices are down from a high of nearly $150 a barrel to about a third of that today. Carlos Salas, who coordinates the Mexican Institute of Labor Studies, says that spells trouble.
We have an insurance for loss in an income in the oil industry, but it will end in October 2009. So next year, with this so low prices, Mexican government is going to have a budgetary real problem because lack of income.
In January, President Calderón announced a stimulus plan for Mexico called the National Agreement for the Promotion of Employment and Family Well-Being. Antonio Ortiz from the embassy.
So this is a society-wide effort to deal with the effects of the crisis. The program has five main areas, which is to maintain employment, to help working families, to support the productive sector, to foster investment and infrastructure, and to enhance transparency and efficiency of public spending.
The plan will cut energy prices by as much as 20%, stimulate temporary employment, and extend medical coverage for unemployed workers. Ortiz says it will also help small businesses, which have historically been too weak to export their products. But critics say the $54 billion package isn't enough. Carlos Salas says no recovery whatsoever is predicted until 2011.
The only manufacturing activity that will grow would be construction because of the infrastructure program of the recovery program, but the rest will not grow at the same rate. So the predicted effect of this recovery package will be very small, very, very small.
Many economists think the recession is showing the downside to Mexico's economic dependence on the U.S. Robert Blecker is an economics professor at American University and a research fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. He says the Mexican growth rate is too externally driven, meaning it depends too much on the U.S. growth rate.
You're waiting for the U.S. to recover. That's the reality. That unless there is a fundamental reorientation of the model, I don't see how Mexico can recover. So the real stimulus is going to be the one coming from the U.S. Congress, from the getting the banking system and the global financial system to recover.
So what would a real economic recovery look like? Carlos Salas says it would involve a restructuring of the Mexican tax system to raise taxes on the rich and close the loopholes they use to avoid paying. He also wants more investment in rural areas and small towns. Manuel Perez Rocha of the Institute for Policy Studies says the problem is the neoliberal model that promotes production for export.
There's a total lack of investment in the internal market, in the endogenous conditions and structural conditions that Mexico should create to really support the creation of jobs.
Perez Rocha and Carlos Salas also want to see the North American Free Trade Agreement renegotiated. Clinton and Obama also support changes to NAFTA to better protect U.S. workers. But the Mexican government has been unwilling to budge. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
Egypt has an estimated 10,000 bloggers. Many have come under heavy scrutiny by state security and have been arrested for their online activism. Some have even reported having been tortured while in detention. Despite the risks, Egyptian bloggers have managed to break a handful of stories, forcing mainstream media to pay attention to what they have to say. Aya Batraoui has more from Cairo.
Out of nowhere, a mob of men attacked a woman and tore her clothes off at a soccer match. That same year, around 300 men attacked three girls in the middle of downtown Cairo in plain view of police, who did nothing to disperse the crowd. Both incidents were caught on camera. A number of bloggers posted these videos on their blogs. They forced mainstream Egyptian media to address the incident that was referred to as a national shame in this predominantly Islamic and traditional society. But the Egyptian government has not seen the work of bloggers as a benefit to society. In fact, many bloggers are arrested and detained, often during protests, since protests without government approval are considered illegal under the current state of emergency. The Egyptian blogger Sand Monkey, who prefers to remain anonymous, was one of the first people in Egypt to start a blog about 4 years ago. With around 10,000 hits per day, his award-winning blog has broke stories that were later picked up by newspapers and TV.
We're information pushers. That's how influential we are.
Sand Monkey sees the internet as the only space left for freedom of speech.
So it becomes the place where people can meet, can express their opinions, find like-minded people. You know, it encourages debate and encourages dialogue, which is something we need in this country for many, many reasons.
Another blogger, Hossam Al-Hamalawi's, gets up to 40,000 hits per month. His blog, Al-Arabawi, is often the first to show video of worker strikes in Egypt and socialist movements around the world. Al-Hamalawi described in vivid detail his abuse at the hands of state security.
I was handcuffed behind my back, and I was blindfolded all the time, and I was stripped naked, threatened with rape and sexual abuse. I was beaten severely. I was also, denied to go to the bathroom. I was deprived from sleep. The first night I was made to stand the whole day and the whole night, and all the time. I mean, there were threats against my family that they were going to rape my mother, they were going to rape my sister.
In a turn of events, nearly 7 years after his arrest, Al-Hamalawi and other bloggers got a hold of a video showing Egyptian police beating and abusing people during interrogation. The scandal led to the unprecedented arrest and conviction of police officers.
We managed to expose the Interior Ministry and give it probably its worst PR scandal ever in its history.
Although there are a number of bloggers currently under arrest, including the controversial blogger Karim Ahmed, most bloggers seem to be unfazed by the risks to their safety. Wearing a lavender scarf embroidered with peace signs, Shehinez Abdesalam described her blog in between sips of a cappuccino at an American coffee shop here in Cairo.
I have also my logo, which is Hanamish Haifin, where we are not afraid.
Abdesalam's blog is called Wahda Mosseya, meaning an Egyptian girl. She blogs about gender issues, politics, and is part of the opposition movement called Kifaya, meaning enough. Although her parents received a phone call from state security regarding their daughter's blogging activities, she continues to blog.
The motivation is for me, myself, is my country, is Egypt.
is the values I believe in. It, as I told you, freedom of expression, freedom and human rights. So this is my motivation, really. I would like to see Egypt and Egyptians in a better situation than now.
According to Professor of Online Journalism, Dr. Naila Hamdi, bloggers have become citizen journalists. More importantly, she believes that bloggers face arrest because they don't have media institutions or press laws to protect them.
You know, they don't have editors and they don't have, you know, anyone to tell them to what to do and what not to do. They also don't have laws to protect them. They don't have syndicates to protect them when they do upset someone or get in trouble, okay? So I think also to think that they are just more, generally, more free than mainstream journalists is not necessarily true.
Despite threats from the government, many of these vanguard bloggers said they support one another through their blogs when one of them is arrested and believe that freedom of expression is a cause worth blogging for. For FSRN from Cairo, this is Aya Batraoui.
I'm sure you don't remember me. And now it's been 10 years. I'm still wondering who to be. And I'd love to mix in circles, cliques, and social coteries. That's me. Hand me my nose and
we be happy.
Show me the mosh pit.
Hey, you are listening to The Underground. It's 6 o'clock here at KBOO 90.7 FM. And our show today is on resistance and activism. And now I'm going to hand it over to Garrett.
First up, we have a piece by Hannah interviewing her mother about activism.
My name is Hannah Morrison, and I go to Nair Early College Academy. I'm here today with my mother.
And my name is Charlene Zaharakis. I was born in Portland, Oregon, 57 years ago.
What were you involved with in the 70s?
Well, in the 70s, it was really the 60s and the 70s because of the Vietnam War. I was in high school in 1968 when I first went to a demonstration. And my brother got me involved. He'd been in the Air Force, so he'd come home and was against the war. He hadn't been in Vietnam, but he was in the military at the time. So he got me thinking about what the government was doing. The other thing that was happening then is that people were questioning authority. They were questioning the way that we did things. And I was in the heart of it because I was in high school. There are things like the dress code. We could not wear pants. We couldn't wear jeans. They thought that if you wore pants to school as a girl, that you would be more rowdy. And it was things like that that seemed to be discriminatory and kind of stereotyping us. And so as youth, we began to protest those things and question those things that had been the norm and the way that people did things. So there was a lot of resistance from the people in authority, like our principal, our teachers, our parents, and those kind of people. So it was on different levels. There was a national level going on, but also I became active at school to make changes. That was the beginning of it.
How did it really affect you today and back then?
Well, back then, I think I had a passion for making change because my own life wasn't the way that I thought it should be. That when I was growing up, I lived in poverty, and I wanted to make changes. I didn't always have control over how things were when I was growing up. But then when I became a teenager, I had more control, And as an adult, after I turned 18, I had more control. And so I wanted to see change made. And that's how it had an effect on me. And so as I saw things that were wrong, or I thought was wrong or a problem, and I wanted to make a change, I felt more empowered to do that. I saw that there was a way that I didn't have to just accept it, that I, as one person with other people, could organize and make a change. And so things like housing, I worked to form a tenants union in the early 70s because people were living in pretty bad situations in terms of what their housing looked like and landlords not making repairs. And workers' rights, I worked at Winchell's at one point. My sister and I, we didn't get breaks, we didn't get overtime, and all those things were illegal to do that. We organized with something called Industrial Workers of the World, and I was able to make some change then in the workplace. It was small things, but they add up. So now, in this time period, what happened is later on, I went back to school and became a nurse. I work as a community health nurse, which put all my skills together, my advocacy for people, together in one package. So that's sort of how I make a change now. So I help people learn how to help themselves and advocate for themselves using resources within the system and make changes in people's lives every day and kind of passing on that power to other people.
So if you can go back, would you change anything?
I think I might have gone to school earlier because I put off going to school. I got a little distracted. And I think that's about the only thing I would have changed, is staying in school, although I did go back later. Maybe now I have a little more perspective, so I don't know. I don't know if I would have changed anything. I think what's really important is that people know that their lives can change in the moment, that people who are living in poverty or in domestic violence or other situations, they don't have to stay in those. They don't have to be the same, that they can make changes. Just because you were born in poverty or born into a situation that you didn't make, you don't have to stay there. That there are ways out to make it a different world. I like the job I do because it's a chance to start over when somebody has a child. I work with moms and babies, and it's a good time for people to make change. And so that's what I work with moms, is to help them become better parents than their parents were, and to take the good things in their parents and to use those, but also to integrate their own change into how they parent their children. And I think that's how we make a different world. We have to start with the children.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for coming and talking about things that was really important to you.
You are welcome.
That was Hannah and her mother talking about activism in Portland. Next up, a piece by the Young Ladies Radio Project on the psychological effects of punishment versus abuse in children. Young Ladies Radio Project is a radio partnership between KBOO and IRCO.
Most people think that physical punishment is something from the past, but as we know, it is still happening today. Many good parents feel that they should punish their children once in a while, but what is an effective way of managing children?
Will you say your name and what your job is, please?
John McNulty. I'm a teacher and a coach at Madison High School. I teach freshmen through seniors. I've got a master's degree in counseling. I've been a counselor in many different forms since 1981, private practice, drug and alcohol, family, CSD. I was an elementary school counselor for 4 years, and then I've been a teacher for approximately now about 19 years.
What is child abuse?
In my opinion, it's there's several different types. There's emotional neglect where you don't, if you're a parent, you don't give the kid proper nurturing to become a better person. There's verbal abuse where you're screaming and yelling at a kid and scaring the hell out of them. There's physical abuse that goes way beyond punishment. It's taking out frustrations. It's hurting somebody that shouldn't be hurt.
What are the main disadvantages of physical punishment to children?
Well, it depends on what type of punishment. If you use physical punishment, as a parent and somebody who's been around it for a while, you end up pushing your kid away.
So how does this negative punishment affect children?
Kids need to know the boundary between what is right and wrong, and a parent needs to know how to establish that boundary between right and wrong. And if that's established early, you know, then a kid will know how far they can go, and a parent actually will know how far the kid will go and how far the parent will go. Punishment is effective when utilized in fair and equal amount, but it has to also be tempered. I mean, if you're going to be putting somebody in, say, timeout, or you're going to be giving them a tongue lashing, you also have to temper that with a little bit of love. Kid wants structure, but a kid also wants love too, and sometimes they go hand in hand.
When does punishment become child abuse?
When punishment becomes child abuse, when you step over the line, when you verbally, emotionally, or physically damage the kid, you know. A physical abuse does more emotionally because the kid's looking at, well, negative punishment is better than no punishment. Okay? Negative attention is better than no attention.
What effects does child abuse have on the child's future?
Oh, God. I mean, studies have shown that if a child is abused at a young age, chances are that they're going to perpetuate that abuse. As it gets older and older, and possibly he's gonna do the same thing. It can become a generational type of problem. If a kid is abused, they feel like on one hand nobody loves me, and on the other hand this is the only love I will ever know.
My name is Olaf Hassan. I'm going to interview Fatima.
Hi, Olaf.
What is the punishment?
In my culture, punishment would be when a child does something wrong, the parent would like, it's okay to hit as long as the child is protected and the child is not being hit really severely bad.
What difference do you see between Somali culture and American culture when it comes into disciplining children?
I see in American culture, the way of disciplining children is more in communicating with them, or maybe not making them have something they want. In my culture, it's more like the way you do with the child is you can hit them or you can talk to them in a way that you make them feel bad that what they did is wrong, and by the respect that they have for the parents is different, so it will be more effective.
Can you hit a child? If so, when? What are the results?
The way of hitting a child would not be in a way that makes him feel pain or something. Just to make him sure he did something bad, you cannot hit in the head or leave some marks on the child's body. You just hit them to make them know that what they did is wrong and they shouldn't do it again.
How is transition to a different culture like American?
So when a child from my culture comes here and sees the idea that hitting a child in any way is wrong, he gets the idea that he cannot be hit again. So you see in many houses a child yells and reacts differently when a parent yells at them or tries to hit them. Those are some differences that I see that is happening in our culture. It's difficult for the parents is because they take it as a disrespect from the children. Well, actually, the child sees another children doing that, and it's okay. There are some difficulties between that.
Thank you, Fatima. Have a nice day.
You too.
Can you introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Julia.
What's your job? What do you
I'm
do for
I'm a stay-at-home mom, and I have four kids and a husband.
What is child abuse?
Child abuse is when the child is being, I would say, hit or kicked or, you know, something when it's done in anger, and I would say physical or mental.
What are the main disadvantages of physical punishment to children?
I would say the main disadvantages would be if the punishment is done in anger and an abusive way. If it's done wrong, that would be a disadvantage in my opinion.
Would you like to introduce yourself, Thorst?
And this is Tamisha Wilson with Department of Human Services.
What is your job?
I'm a social service specialist.
How do you define child abuse and punishment?
I don't have a set definition. Child abuse comes in many different forms, physical, verbal, sexual, psychological, and if you're referring to physical punishment, if a mark is left, and it depending on the age of the child, really depends on if that would qualify as abuse to that certain child. There's a lot of factors that play into that, since there's not a definite or definitive description of it.
How do you think the negative punishment affect children?
Children need discipline, and oftentimes punishment is a little extreme, although necessary, but there are many forms of punishment that work better than physical punishment. Loss of privileges or making them do extra chores or allowing them to even set their own punishment sometimes helps better than a physical punishment.
Okay. How does physical punishment will affect future child's life? Is it cyclical? Will they do the same on their own children?
It depends. Most often people choose to take things that they appreciated, learning from their parents and passing that on to their children. Sometimes the things that they didn't like, they don't integrate that into their parenting style. But most oftentimes, new parents tend to rely on advice, you know, from the people that they know and trust. We don't see a lot of cycles. Sometimes, you know, people do fall into a cycle that their parents did if it was negative, but a lot of the times they don't. And so it just depends on the situation and what advantages that person has had.
Okay. What is the proper balance of punishment what parents can use to have a positive effect on the child's life?
Asking a lot of questions, getting advice, you know, from people who know, and taking that in, using that they feel would be an appropriate punishment. I advise them to go with what is recommended by professionals.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
The Young Ladies Radio Project is a production of KBOO and the Immigrant Refugee Community Organization, IRCO.
That studies science, technology, engineering, and math.
As it affects us, our world, and the life of the people around us.
The views of this program are strictly that of the individuals interviewed, are not representatives of IRCO or as a organization.
Next up, a field recording by youth advocate Aaron Yankee at Rosa Parks Elementary School.
The KBOO Youth Collective was invited to Rosa Parks Elementary School to record their after-school writers group. We first hear from their teachers, Walida Emerisha and Taria Autry.
My name is Walida Emerisha, and I'm working with Community of Writers, and we are working here at Rosa Parks Elementary School, working with fourth graders in their writers club.
Hi, my name is Taria Autry, and I've been working with Community of Writers for close to a decade, I think, now, and this year they're doing this amazing project with Rosa Parks Elementary School that involves writers coming in during the day and working with classes, as well as what we're doing, which is coming in twice a week after school, working with small groups doing writers clubs.
It's been half a year, and we're having a great time, and we get to work with the kids until June, and it's an amazing opportunity that was gotten through a grant that Portland Public Schools and Community of Writers did. The first quarter, we put together a zine of their writings, and then this quarter, we're doing the radio work with you. Thank you so much for coming in. And then next quarter, actually, we're looking to do another zine, and there's been a huge crowd roar about doing comic books. Also, we'll be doing a community performance in spring as well for the wider community, and we've been doing write nights as well once a term so that parents can come in with their students, and that's open to anyone at school. They come in and can write as a family, which is really exciting. The students have done amazing work, and they've come so far, and they've done so much, and they were so excited to be on the radio. So we appreciate you guys coming in, and we appreciate folks listening to them. And
hi, my name is Firefighters are skirting water at intersections. It feels like you're getting pushed and people are fighting for life.
Hello, my name is Lily. Today I'm going to read you a poem named Gift of My Fingers. Gift of my fingers, sickle and electric wind, at times everybody is creepy. My hands automatically stop against a very cold, icy mountain. And as I travel, I feel like a blasting volcano shooting out with magma and lava. I imagine lava that looks like blood that comes out of rocks, streaming into houses, streets, apartments, hospitals, and into people's lives. But I see the lava and the world starts to break into pieces of rock.
My name is Jacob, and this is a poem, Mighty Sister. It's a fun time. My sister's coming, and I didn't go to school for 3 days straight. This is my fourth. She always set up her crib and playpen, and now I can feel what it's like to have a sister. Now it's time to welcome your home into her own house. We have a new baby. She's a little baby. She doesn't open her eyes that much. We're excited to see her. She can open her eyes wide open. She gets really hyper when we play with her. My life has changed. She is my first sister. I really love her, and I think she's going to be a beautiful sister. I'm asleep in a car, coming home from the hospital. I'm going to see my older brother. He's going to look out for me. He's going to play with me. We're going to love each other forever and ever.
Hello, my name is Katie with Sunwalk Life. My story's name is Daniel's Unicorn. The unicorn smells clean. It is as blue as a delicious raspberry. It feels smooth like a ginger is first. It reminds me of her helping other people who like to help people. And her when the unicorn gets to the
out too. Make new friends. Remember, don't hate, appreciate. Try to be a good person. You could be a superstar. Be nice. If you are a liar, you better stop now. If you lie a lot, then you tell the truth. The person you are telling it to might not believe you, so don't lie. Are you nice all the time and you smile? Keep up the good work. But if something gets in your way and you start talking back, wipe your sleeve. Calm down. Don't let something crazy get in the way. Get over it. You will become popular too. By AJ Hill McKinnon.
My name is Jenna, and my poem is When I grow up, I want to be a doctor. I want to help people with their health. I want to help them pay their medicine and most important with their sickness. Lots of people will one day thank me for helping all of them. A poem for my mom, Amar.
My mom also all day long reads medical videos. It's not like it's for us to get to sleep. And it is for her and for her mother. Some people always ask her where to get all of it. She reads for Christmas secrets because I get it from a special girl because she never learns over it. So we go up and she learns it. Her goal is to live in the
For more information about the program, visit www.communityofwriters.com. For the KBOO Youth Collective, this is Erin Yankee, KBOO Youth Advocate.
Next, Annie takes a short discourse on the Black Power movement of the late 1960s and tells us what it was all about.
Who taught you to hate the texture of your hair? Who taught you to hate the color of your skin to such extent that you bleach to get like the white man? Who taught you to hate the shape of your nose and the shape of your lips? Who taught you to hate yourself from the top of your head to the soles of your feet? Who taught you to hate your own kind? Who taught you to hate the race that you belong to? So much so that you don't want to be around each other. No, before you come asking Mr. Muhammad, does he teach hate? You should ask who yourself, who taught you to hate being what God gave you.
The civil rights movement of the 1960s is one of the most celebrated periods of American history. In the wake of 1954's Brown v. Board of Education, the movement mobilized people of color across the nation, and leaders such as Martin Luther King Jr. spoke to the whole country and preached nonviolent equality. The New Deal reigned in an era of federal committees and programs to benefit Americans, but more often than not, these benefits did not apply to blacks. Even the GI Bill frequently cheated black veterans out of what they were promised. President Lyndon B. Johnson sought to enforce the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments that had been oppressed for decades after their ratification by Jim Crow laws and still generally racist attitudes held by whites in the South and even in the North. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 and Voting Rights Act of 1965 are considered the hallmarks of the Civil Rights Movement. Less recognized, though arguably equally significant, was the Black Power Movement, born in June of 1966. Led by figures such as Stokely Carmichael of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Malcolm X of the Nation of Islam, and Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale, founders of the Black Panther Party, Black Power subscribed to the tenet of civil rights by any means necessary and with all deliberate speed. Their interest lay in the empowerment of the black community through cultural heritage, pride, and nationalism. The Black Panther Party, who originally formed in the racially dissonant Oakland area, armed themselves with guns and constitutions to protect their neighborhoods from police brutality and condone violence when necessary, a marked distinction from civil rights groups from a previous generation. Black Power had many different schools of thought. There were numerous groups that believed in black separatism, neo-Garveyism, and black supremacy, to name a few. The general ideology that most black power groups held was racial pride, black autonomy, and the creation of black political and cultural institutions that would fight for the advancement of black collective interests. Black power enabled black studies programs at many colleges, encouraged the election of black politicians, and raised the pride and esteem that was often lacking in African Americans collectively. Although black power often neglected the interests of feminism, it later allowed for a reactionary movement and criticism of black power in what came to be black feminism. Though this movement proved to have a number of flaws, its impact on American racial politics is undeniable, and its audacity ought to be recognized just as much as its more peaceful and idealized predecessors. All right, that was a piece by me, Annie, and up next we have a piece by Zoe, and she's going to read it live.
Hey, this is Zoe. I wrote up a piece about the Saving the Rainforest, so here it is. Hello, KBOO. Any wonderful animal. The rainforest is not only home to many wonderful animals, but also wonderful plants. Rainforest plants have already provided lots of evidence of their potential with remedies for all sorts of medical problems. from childhood leukemia to toothaches. 70% of the plants identified as having anti-cancer characteristics by the U.S. National Cancer Institute are found only in the tropical rainforest. Destroying the rainforest also means destroying people. Though in my book, saving land and animals is enough. If that's not enough for you, think about saving yourself. What if cancer runs in your family? What if you get it, but by the time it is brought to your attention, there's not enough rainforest? I googled how many animals are being killed each year, hoping to find something out about what was killing the rainforest was doing. The results were devastating. 100 species in the rainforest are killed each day, and 9,021 animals are killed each day on average by rainforest deforestation. If you could save even one animal a day, wouldn't you feel better? By helping save the rainforest, you can not only help animals, but plants and people as well. I know what you're thinking. I don't have enough kind of money for that, save that kind of land. Well, I know a way that's free. Go to www.therainforest.com and click the Remember to Click link that brings you to a big green button. Then just click it. They're counting clicks, and every click is saving more rainforest. Click every day. I just saved 11.4 square feet of rainforest. I know that I'm helping. So once again, that website was www.therainforest.com. Thanks.
This is Katrina, and I'm here with Lisa Gilley, a local activist, and we're talking about activism. Welcome to KABU, Lisa.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And how would you describe activism?
Activism, to me, is going beyond your beliefs and taking action, standing up for what you believe is right. And it can be as simple as recycling or taking your own cloth bags to the grocery store, or as intense as protesting in the streets.
When did you first learn about activism?
In the late 1960s. The civil rights movement was peaking at that time, and Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated. Also, the Vietnam War was continuing, and more people began to speak out and protest against our involvement there, especially college students.
How did they protest?
Well, they staged protests, carrying signs, speaking out against the war, and they also had what they called sit-ins, where they would take over a building and stay until someone listened to try to get media attention to get the word out to the country that, hey, what was going on was wrong. Most of these happen at colleges and universities. And during one protest at Kent State University in Ohio, 4 unarmed students were shot and killed by Ohio State National Guardsmen.
Wow, you know a lot about activism and protests. Did you protest?
Yes, I did. In the spring of 1970, I was 18 and I was a senior in high school.
What was the protest like?
Well, one evening I went into Portland to join students at Portland State University. We barricaded the streets near the university to protest, and we also held a sit-in inside one of the buildings. It was mostly peaceful, except at one point, a city garbage truck rammed through one of the barricades. Luckily, no one was hurt. And during the day, however, while I was not there, police did use their batons on the protesters.
Have you protested against the war in Iraq?
No, I have not. I do foster care now, and I knew that I couldn't risk injury or arrest while I was responsible for the care of a child. But I did vote for John Kerry in 2004 and Barack Obama in 2008 and helped some young people register to vote in this last election.
What do you recommend to young people who want to become activists?
Well, first of all, it's really important to care about your world and the people in it. Not just caring about yourself, but looking outward to others. Secondly, it's very important to become informed. Not just from mainstream TV, radio, or the newspapers, which absolutely do not tell all of the truth of situations like Vietnam or Iraq. Listen to stations like KABU and NPR. Read some non-stream newspapers and magazines like the Utney Reader. Get involved in your community with like-minded people to affect positive changes. Your one voice does have power and meaning, and that power can grow when you join with others.
And do you have anything else you'd like to say?
All right, that was a piece by Katrina, and she interviewed Lisa, who talked about her days doing activism work. And up next, we have a piece by Zoe Ace, and she interviews people who are both self-employed and work at an office to see what the difference is and how they feel about their jobs.
The theme for this month's Underground Show was activism and resistance. At first, my piece started out as resisting the man, which turned into interviewing someone who worked in an office building and interviewing someone who owned their own business. The point was to compare how people felt about their jobs and how they felt about their lifestyle relating to their jobs. And this is what I came up with.
Hi, my name is Steve Kane. I'm 27. I live in the Ukrainian village in Chicago. And I work for a marketing company.
Okay, you went to Columbia College in Chicago, right?
Yeah, I actually went twice. Like, I went originally for music business, and then I took some time off because I realized it wasn't really what I wanted to do. And I went back for journalism and finished like a year of that. So I actually still have like to go back technically. I mean, to finish my degree, I still have like another year and a half left or so.
Why did you go back for journalism?
It's kind of one of those things where my mom is actually a journalism teacher at a high school, or she was. I don't know. I just kind of. I'd always been a decent writer. I'd always written. I'd always kept journals. I'd always, you know, wrote poetry. I'd always, when I was in high school, I did a zine for my entire, you know, high school career where I would just talk about, like, punk bands and things like that. So I figured that, you know, considering I was doing this anyway, it was something that would be a good fit for me. And it was. I was a good journalism student, you know.
How did you end up getting the job that you have now?
I had quit my other job, and I didn't have one. My friend Drew had told me that his company was hiring, and, you know, he kind of gave me the rundown on the job, and so I kind of got hired that way.
How long have you been working there?
It'll be 2 years in June, so it's been a while.
What's your favorite part of your job?
There's a lot of diversity, and there's also a lot of people who are involved in other things. So it's kind of a great place to work because there are people there who are musicians, there are people there who are like comedians and actors, and like they do improv, and there's like writers there, and there are people who write plays, and like so there's a lot of creativity there, and I think that's a cool thing for like a young company to have. It's cool being able to, like, walk into a place and, like, and have work with a lot of your friends and, like, you know, have a really good rapport with all of your coworkers and things like that.
What's your least favorite part of your job?
It's a really repetitious job. And you basically do the same thing every day, all day. It's kind of one of the things where I always wanted a job that I feel, like, personal satisfaction with, and I can't always say that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Things can always be better, I think, that that's anyone's life, you know.
What would be your ideal job?
Kind of one of those things where I think about this all the time now. Especially, like, the older I get, the more I think about it. Because, when I was a kid, I never really wanted to be anything. Like, I never really thought about it. If it were feasible and I could pay my rent and, like, live a fairly comfortable life, if it was possible to just be in a band and, like, do that full-time, I probably would, because that seems to be the only thing that, like, I've consistently enjoyed, because I've never had to do it as my full-time job, so I guess I don't really know. Right now, it's still, like, appealing enough to where that seems like a really fun way to live.
Does your work schedule affect, like, other aspects of your life, like hanging out with friends or, like, going on vacation or anything?
Not really at all. Actually, that is a really good perk of my job, too, is that, like, it's, like, when my roommates and my friends, Too Sweet, went on tour last year, they did some dates with their fans, Set Your Goals. And, like, basically, I just, you know, let my work know, and then I had vacation time saved up, and I was able to do that. I was gone for, like, 10 days, I think, 7 days. And, you know, it didn't matter. They're really cool about stuff like that. Like, since there's so many people that are involved in things, like, you know, my friend Drew that got me the job, he's in two bands. And, you know, he'll go on tour with other bands. And they're, like, really cool with that. You know, within reason, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to drop your blog spot?
Yeah, I have a music blog called Harsh Distractions. It's, harshdistractions.blogspot.com, and I have a personal blog, and it's Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N-T, and Christopher Kane.blogspot.com, and that's Kane, K-A-N-E. And that's what I do when I'm at work. I mean, they let me update my blog while I'm at work all day if I want.
That's awesome.
That's kind of awesome.
My first question is, who are you and what do you do?
My name is Jenny Wells, and I have a glass studio called Jennifer Wells Design. I teach people in the community how to make glass by fusing it in a kiln and cutting it and all that stuff. I also make my own art.
Do you enjoy owning your own business?
Yes, I do enjoy owning my own business. It's a lot of work, a lot more work than I realized it ever would be, but it's really fun being your own boss and setting your own schedule and getting to dictate all of what happens in your business.
Okay, does it make it easier or harder to take, like, vacations and stuff?
Well, I can certainly plan classes around when I have my vacations and things like that. It can be hard, though, because then if you're gone, you're not making money for the business, so that part is difficult. So you have to kind of plan ahead to save money and make sure that there is going to be enough income while you're gone to cover all of your expenses.
How long did it take to start everything?
Well, I started working on it, on the business plan in the summer, and it took me, I just had never written a business plan before, so that took me just figuring that out. But the Small Business Association had all sorts of models for business plans, so I kind of used some of theirs and wrote my business plan. And then we were fortunate to own a house, so I took out a loan, second mortgage on our house.
What are your favorite and least favorite parts of owning
it? My favorite part is definitely that I get to create all that happens in the business, and I get to meet a lot of really great people in the community because they come in and take classes, so that's really, really fun. I feel like I get to know lots and lots of people in the community, and I get to work in schools. Probably the least favorite part is all of the money and organizational parts of the business, because organization has never been my strong point since I'm an artist. So trying to stay organized with all the finances and paying taxes and that sort of thing, that can be a real pain. And if you don't stay on top of it, then you owe a whole lot of money. So I've gotten better about that now that it's almost the third year in business. My website is jenniferwellsdesign.com, and my address is 1614 Northeast Alberta, and my phone number is 503-750-4921.
All right. Just in case you tuned in recently, you are listening to The Underground, which is the Youth Public Affairs Show on KBOO 90.7 FM. And our show this month is about resistance and activism. And you just heard a piece by Zoe Ace interviewing a couple of people about the differences of being self-employed and being working in an office. Up next, we have an interview by Marina with Miriam Medina. So let's listen to that.
Hello, this is Marina, and I interviewed Maria Medina, the program director for Beats for Peace, an American Friends Service Committee-sponsored youth group. A Portland native, Maria began her career teaching art classes at various youth groups and camps. She has since worked at the Rock and Roll Camp for Girls and worked and organized for Oregon Action, a nonprofit that works on campaigns to advance social, economic, and racial justice. She started at the American Friends Service Committee as an intern with Beats for Peace and has been program director for a year. So tell us about Beats for Peace and the work you do with the kids.
Well, Beats for Peace is a youth arts and activism program, and we mainly focus on urban arts, and we basically create art in response to social justice issues, issues of injustice, and various types of oppression, and basically build events and art pieces. And we also have a youth-led zine called United Voices.
Have you seen changes in the kids after joining the youth group?
I think I have, especially lately, because I think right now there's like a 12-year-old and a 13-year-old. So we have like some younger youth members in the group right now. So I would say it's been interesting to see them grow into developing activists and actually having a response, a bigger response in, I think, creating social change. And especially some of the younger kids recently, now that everyone's kind of banding together to get the zine done and finished on a timeline, I've seen everyone in the group step up, and I think it's the first time that I've actually noticed the amounts of energy being put into everything. I don't know, it's really beautiful, because like kids go from not caring to caring a whole bunch, and that's good.
Why is activism important for youth?
Well, I guess that depends on how you, I guess, describe activism, but for me, it's just doing something about something you don't like in the world. So even if you don't like people slamming your door and you put like a door stop in there so that it doesn't slam, so it's like doing something proactive to kind of change reality, and I think that's what like activism is to me. It's just like doing something about the things that I don't like, and so I really get a big kick out of seeing youth have an opinion and doing something about their future, and they are the future. And hanging out with kids all the time, you get to be a big kid. It's great fun. And it's also, I think, developing good leadership in all of the youth involved and all youth who do activism. I think you have to be some sort of leader to be able to take worldly issues on as a kid. So props to youth activists. Woo woo.
What do you see happening in the future with Beats for Peace?
Well, I know in the near future we will be having a spring zine, Spring 09, and I'm really excited about it. The theme is kind of like youth speaking out, and kind of it's kind of a variety magazine, which is different than what we've done in the past. Usually there's like an issue or a topic, and so all of the youth submissions are about that topic or subject. And this time it's kind of just young people saying whatever they have to say about the world, and I'm really excited about it. There's some great works in there, and that's one thing that I'm looking forward to and like waiting to see grow, seeing people's response when they pick up the zine and find out that it is youth led and youth created and youth edited. It's a pretty big deal, and it's all in color and glossy. So I'm really looking forward to that in the future of Beats for Peace.
Do you have any advice for adults on how to engage youth in activism?
Well, I would say one thing is, like, in the activist community and in peace communities, there's, like, a whole nother language. So I would say when you're talking to kids, like, speak plain English and try to hit them at a level that they care about. And I think that, you know, the way that Beats for Peace works is that we use, like, you know, hip-hop, and we use, you know, graffiti and various forms of art to be able to, like, talk to kids about youth and militarism or war or the peace movement and those kinds of things. So I would say just like find something that kids like to do and then use that as a vehicle to speak with the young.
Is there anything else you wanted to add?
I think I would just like to add that we would like everyone in the community and all young people to come to the Beats for Peace zine release party. That is going to be on April 4th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Audio Cinema. And Audio Cinema's address is 226 Southeast Madison, right under the Hawthorne Bridge. And we're going to be having some youth performances and youth speakers and all of the zines your heart could ever want. It's a fundraiser. The event is free, but we are having a raffle, and we are raffling off zine bundles and trying to get folks to buy bundles of zines. So I think one thing that's really exciting is the way that, like, we're bundling the zines so that someone can donate $5. And for that donation of $5, that means that three young people will be able to have a free zine. I think that's really cool. It's a good reason to come. And also because we're going to have some really great music. We're going to have live performances by Thavius Beck, Cancer the Kid, Spamtron, DJ Grimrock, and the Gummy Cub Crew, which is like a group of little kids that rap and sing, and I make their beats. So, yeah, it's pretty dope. But again, Beats for Peace, zine release at Audio Cinema on April 4th from 5 to 8, 226 Southeast Madison Street under the Hawthorne Bridge.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right. To learn more about Beats for Peace, visit www.afsc.org and search Beats for Peace. And or you can check out their MySpace, which is myspace.com/whitedvoices. Yeah. And up next, we have a piece by Kim, and she's going to talk about resisting common knowledge.
Hello, my name is Kim Koffel, and this evening I'm going to be dictating about resisting common knowledge. More specifically, resisting common knowledge that washing my hands is really necessary. Many people I've conversed with believe that washing your hands is simply not needed. My first reaction to this, of course, is to be disgusted, but it got me thinking. Are the risks of not bothering to sterilize my digits and palms really that nasty? I searched the deep chasms of my brain, but the only answers I could dig up were vague taglines that I've been brainwashed to recite ever since I was a child. Catchphrases such as, you'll get sick, or spread disease to others. But I had no answers as to how you'll get sick, what diseases you'll spread, or how high the risk truly is. I'm joined now by,
I'm Dr. Coco. What's up, dear? It's very nice to meet you.
It's very nice to meet you, Mrs. Coco. First question is, ever since I was in adults have been emphasizing how important it is to wash my hands before meals and after using the restroom.
Oh, yes, it's very true.
I would like to hear your perspective on when and why I should wash my hands.
You should always wash your hands. All the time. You should wash your hands, before you eat breakfast, before you eat lunch, and before your dinner, before you go to bed, after you shake hands with somebody. After you go to the bathroom.
What about when you sneeze?
After you sneeze. Yes, very much. So?
Always use gloves. That's a good one.
Always use gloves. Every time. All the time.
Could you give specific examples of what could happen if I do not wash my hands?
You'll die.
What are the odds of those occurring?
One in one. One out of one.
I'll die all the time if I don't wash my hands.
See, see. That's it.
Wow, that's pretty intense.
Okay, I will Google it. Okay, you need to wash your hands when you touch your eyes. You pick up germs from other sources and then you infect yourself when you touch animals or animal waste, when your hands are dirty, and more frequently when someone is sick in your home. Oh, I will tell you the correct way to wash your hands. First, wet your hands and apply liquid or clean bar soap. Place the bar soap on a rack and allow it to drain. Next, rub your hands vigorously together. Scrub, covering all surfaces. Continue for 10 to 15 seconds, or about the length of a little tune. That's the hand washing soap. And then rinse your hands very well and dry them. It is estimated that 1 out of 3 people do not wash their hands after using the restroom. So these tips are also important when you're out in public. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, and P.S. Washing your hands regularly can save a lot of money from your medical bills because it costs less than a penny. You could say that this is a penny's worth of prevention can save you $50 visiting the doctor. That's a true fact.
Interesting. But I've heard that washing your hands with antibacterial soap causes super viruses.
This is true.
Could you please explain what a super virus actually is so that listeners know what you're talking about?
When you wash your hands with antibacterial soap, it kills 99.9% of germs, and so that 0.01 germs that is not killed, that's a super germ! And, I don't know, it doesn't get killed, so it's very bad because it's immune to whatever you wash your hands with.
Kind of like cockroaches.
See.
And then it becomes a super virus that kills you.
So it becomes a super virus and it's not killed by antibiotics. Or
in fact, I think that's how the plague started.
In fact, the Black Plague was because people did not wash their hands. They didn't even have soap. Oh, listen to this. When you do not wash your hands, germs will spread all over your hands. Once germs invade your body, they gobble up nutrients and energy and produce toxins, which are poisons. These toxins can produce symptoms of common infections like fevers, sniffles, rashes, coughing, vomiting, and diarrhea.
In public places, we all see the signs on the walls inside the bathroom that say, like, you know, wash your hands.
Yes, I see them. I can see.
Complete with directions, too. So. Why did people decide it was mandatory to wash your hands for public places?
Because it's common sense.
Yeah, but if it's common sense, then why do people need to be told all the time?
Because people are stupid.
Oh, what if there's no soap in the bathroom? Is it still worth it to try and wash your hands even though you're just using water?
Sissy, you can drown the germs.
Drown them?
Sissy.
Are women more susceptible to diseases from not washing their hands than men?
No.
Why?
Because, they're the same in susceptibleness of the diseases. Yes. Yes.
Interesting.
Yes, it is.
That's all the questions I have for today.
Oh, thank you. I was very bored. Hello again, hello. Hello.
Just so you guys know, you probably should not listen to any medical advice we just give out because Dr. Coco is not a physician. Neither am I.
I am a physician!
Don't listen to anything we say. Do not follow anything we do except for wash your hands. That's the only advice we can give out.
I went to UCLA. Banana slugs, go!
All right, that was Kim Koffel for the KBU Youth Collective. And up next, we have a piece by Girls, Inc. That we were supposed to play last month, but we didn't have enough time, so here it is.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is KBU Radio, FM 90.7. I am Bree.
Hi, my name is Inga.
My name is Sasha.
Hi, I'm Alana.
Hi, my name is Kristen Robinson. I've been with Girls, Inc. for 3 years now.
I've been going for, I think, since December, the beginning of December.
Just 2 weeks now.
Yeah.
I've been going since the start of September.
Girls Incorporated is a group of girls where you just go in and you usually just talk about your feelings, and we do a whole bunch of games and express how we're doing in school, and we do activities on the economy and things like that. My favorite part is where we get to express our feelings and, you know, who we like and who we don't like and solve problems, and how we just get to spend time with old home friends and meet new people and things like that.
The reason why I like Girls Inc. is because there's so many different people in it that I don't know. Some of them I haven't been comfortable with, and I didn't know, like, really who they were and everything. But now that I've been going to it, I feel better about myself around them, and I feel more comfortable. I like that instead of, like, doing educational things and, like, learning that afterwards, like, after we learn all this stuff and it's all jammed into our brains, we don't have to associate school with all this work. It can just be a time for fun and for play, and you don't have to go to home afterwards, and you just have a place where you can be with your friends, and it's a fun environment.
Girls Incorporated is a group where girls can get together and talk about their feelings and talk about, like, the outside world and, like, the real world when we get older.
Well, I'll say we talk about, like, anything, like, been going on in our life. Like, we could tell people our secrets and stuff.
Hey, sorry we didn't have enough time to finish that. Thank you for listening to The Underground. The Underground is hosted every fourth Wednesday by the KBOO Youth Collective. We meet every Wednesday at KBOO at 6 p.m. to plan our show. If you're interested in getting involved, come on down or call our youth advocate, Aaron Yankee, at 503-231-8032, extension 221, or email at advocate@kboo.org. We also do a music show, Youth Randomonium, the last Friday of every month from 10 to midnight. We're always looking for music by anyone under 21 of any style. And check out our website at kbooyouth.org. Next up is Hard Knock Radio with David D. Thanks for listening.